Welcome on to a Monday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. Danny, no game today. I'm going through total withdrawal. I don't know what to do, but fortunately we got a good show for you planned anyway, previewing both Warriors-Rockets and Hawks-Cavaliers, and we'll also get into what's going to be an interesting offseason for the Clippers, which Danny wrote a good piece on today. So how you doing, man?
I'm doing well. I actually kind of appreciate having the day off. What I've been having a withdrawal on is when I realized on Saturday that there were going to be no days with multiple games anymore, because that's something I really like, is I like the feeling of, you know, riding a wave from one game into another, and that's done for the rest of the season.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, spending 6 hours a day watching basketball can be a little bit much when you're doing it day after day and then recording a podcast afterwards, so hopefully, but we're going to give you double the analysis of each game to make up for
it. That's not physically possible. We already did an hour on more than two games. I don't think we can do more than that. At least, maybe you can find a replacement for me who can. I don't know.
All right, well, so why don't we talk first about the West, Warriors-Clippers, or geez, no, it is not Warriors-Clippers, much to their chagrin. It is Warriors-Rockets, and obviously, there was a historical collapse by the Clippers, but the Rockets, do you think that they found something in the end of that series that's going to allow them to compete with the Warriors in this series?
Compete? Sure. Yeah, I think that one of the things that's out there now is, oh, the Warriors went 4-0 against the Rockets, and some people have done a nice job talking about how those games are not a representative sample. And I do think that the Rockets, as presently constructed, are, excluding the Patrick Beverley injury, are better situated to handle the Warriors, especially because the depth at power forward, I think, is a very nice thing. And also, Clint Capella has played pretty well for what he is in the playoffs, and that's a nice little bonus for them. But being competitive and winning games, and more accurately, winning the series, are very different things. I think that one of the things you talked about with Balvagaris, which I thought was a good point, is that, you know, the pathways for the Rockets to win this series, which is really what matters. I mean, we can talk about the number of games and all that, but the pathways for them to win this series, absent injury, are very narrow.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And for those who and I can't imagine why this would be the case, but who missed my podcast with Bob, we talked about how the referees and fouling was going to be a key factor in this series, because Golden State really likes it when there are less calls. Bogut and Green are guys who protect the basket and do better when there aren't fouls being called, and then Golden State can get out and run, whereas Houston, for their scoring, specifically Harden and Dwight also, are very dependent on getting fouled, slowing the game down in that respect. So I think that that's going to be a big factor, is the referees. But let's get in now a little bit more to some of the specific matchups. And I think that the number one strategic question here for Houston in this series is, who's going to guard Steph Curry?
Considering the way that they handled Chris Paul, I think that you start with the point guards, and if you have to work on other guys, you do that. But I think that you also do something similar to what Memphis did, which is, you know, you have a team effort. You have the idea that he's not going to see a ton of single coverage, but one of the big flaws for the Rockets is, without Beverley, they don't have a reliable single cover guy. So a team concept seems like the only real way to do it.
Yeah, well, I mean, your other option would be, you know, obviously Harden is not going to guard Curry. Your other option would be going with Trevor Ariza on Curry. And I think Ariza, just in a vacuum, can be an effective defender on Curry. One of his real strengths as a pick-and-roll defender is that he has a lot of length, and he uses it well to bother guys' shots from behind. And I remember when he was playing for Washington last year, DJ Augustin is no Steph Curry, but Ariza was basically able to completely stop Augustin from taking three-pointers in the pick-and-roll, even though Washington was dropping their bigs back pretty far, just because he was able to get over the screen and still use his length to contest. Now, I don't know how effective he'll be on that with Curry, and Curry, you know, if he gets over once, they'll rescreen, and, you know, even letting a three go up from beyond the arc off the dribble with Curry is kind of a death sentence. So I think and then your other problem when you have Ariza on the point guard is, now your help defenders are going to be either Jason Terry or Prigioni trying to, I mean, I guess you would hide them on someone like, you know, Iguodala or Barnes, and Barnes really was very effective attacking that alignment as well. So, you know, maybe you can't do that anymore the way you might have earlier in the season. And then Harden, you know, who is he going to guard now? Is he going to guard Klay Thompson? Well, that's going to be pretty difficult for him too. They're going to run him off all sorts of screens and dribble handoffs, tire him out. And Thompson does a great job on him at the other end by staying disciplined. So it's really, you're in a tough situation. If you're going to put Ariza on Curry, now you've got Harden having to guard Klay, and you're really going to be kind of in a bind. I think maybe you just have to live with whatever Curry is going to do to Prigioni or Jason Terry.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a pattern to it. The other thing, which we haven't seen the Rockets do a ton, but I think they'll consider and potentially, you know, use more, is the idea of going without what we would call a traditional point guard defensively, which is you play, James Harden is going to run the offense anyway. So you just have James Harden, but so instead of Prigioni or Jason Terry, you play Corey Brewer. And so what you have then is you have a lot more defensive versatility, you have length, and you're losing some shooting because, except for the craziness of Game 6, James Harden isn't going to bring what Jason Terry does. And I think that would be a counter move that the Rockets can do, but the downside of that also is that it really weakens your what would be called swingman depth, you know, your twos and threes, because you're playing them at the same time. But I think that could end up being their best five.
Well, I think another option is going to be for Golden State will be putting Harden on Draymond Green.
Yep.
Although then, you know, is Harden going to play? You're going to have a situation where if they're going to switch, then you're going to get Harden on Curry, which is not going to be great if they run a 1-4 pick and roll, or Harden is going to have to play pick and roll defense. That may not work out all that well.
And you also lose Josh Smith as a help defender. You know, if you're something with that, you know, if you're going to start sliding them off, granted Draymond tries to stray far enough that a guy like Josh would be pulled out a little bit too far to help, but I like Josh a lot as a help defender, and that'll be a challenge if you do that kind of thing, if you're putting him on, let's say, like Harrison Barnes.
Yeah, I mean, it is, with Green, he's not a guy who's going to hurt you in the post. That's sort of the next step in his evolution, is when you guard him with a real small guy for him to be able to take advantage of that. But, you know, he's only 6'6", and he's never really been a guy who's posted up much, even back in college. So it's, and also Harden is a pretty decent post defender, with sort of his bulk, from the shooting guard position. So that's a thought, that they'll go more with him playing the four defensively. But I agree with you that not having Smith is an issue. However, you might say that the Warriors don't get fouled a lot. They have a lot of points in the paint, but that's due more to their shooting and spreading guys out. And so having additional mobility rather than shot blocking at the rim could be a bigger deal. And you think that, you know, if Bogut is in, Howard can provide enough of that. So we may see the Rockets go smaller. But the other issue then is, as you said, the lack of depth. I mean, if they're going to have Prigioni or Terry, and then Harden, Ariza, and Corey Brewer, now if you want to run with that lineup, you know, with that small lineup most of the time, then who are you bringing in off the bench to augment that group? Then you got to go really deep into guys like Papanikolaou or Nick Johnson, guys who don't really play a ton for them. So, yeah, I mean, I think the Warriors present some pretty severe matchup problems for the Rockets without Beverly, because, you know, you've got your one and your two man. Neither of them are really that fantastic defensively, and you've got big studs at the one and two in Curry and Thompson for Golden State.
Yeah, and I think one thing we can agree on is that Dwight Howard is going to have to be huge for the Rockets to have a chance in this series, and he certainly has the capability of it. I think Dwight has had some really, really strong moments in this playoffs. I've been a big fan of his defensively for a long time, and we talked about this in terms of the Clippers series, is that he's nice. He's a very talented player at being on one guy but still affecting another. And the nice thing for him in this series is that Andrew Bogut is not as dangerous as DeAndre Jordan in terms of those kind of quick changes of movement in terms of the ball. You know, Blake, you're not going to see as many You're not going to see as many Draymond to Bogut moves, though we have seen that a little bit in the playoffs. And so I think Dwight's going to have to be the hinge point, even more probably than Harden, if they're going to win this.
Well, do you think they're going to try and post up Dwight a lot in this series? Is that what you're saying?
No, what I'm saying is defensively that I think you can have Dwight hang out a little bit away from Bogut without getting smoked in the same way that he had to be a little bit closer to DeAndre. Offensively, he's not going to be a big factor.
Yeah, Dwight had pretty much zero success trying to post up in the two games that he did play in the regular season, and it had a lot of turnovers. The Warriors are really good at digging down and getting their hands in on his post-ups. I think it might be a worthwhile strategy to just see if he could maybe get something going or get Bogut into a little bit of foul trouble and get him out of the game. But yeah, I mean, I think Dwight's days as a premium post-up guy, and not that there are many left in the league, may have passed unless he's going against kind of a weaker defender. So, and the Rockets have had a lot of success going with the pick and roll and then trying to get it to their shooters. But I think Golden State is just perfectly set up with all their length and quickness on the wing to take away those types of plays.
Yeah, I definitely agree. In terms of one of the adaptations we saw from the Rockets during the Clippers series was that they moved Josh Smith into the starting lineup. How do you think that the difference between Terrence Jones and Josh Smith will play out in this series?
Well, is this this new amazing three-point shooting Josh Smith, or is it the normal Josh Smith?
I'm pretty sure against the Warriors it's going to be the normal Josh Smith.
Yeah, well, it may well be, and I think they'll do a little better job getting out in him too, because I think a lot of his threes came from Blake just being so exhausted that he couldn't get out there. I don't expect the Golden State to suffer nearly so much from that issue. And a lot of times they'll probably be going small with Barnes at the four as well, guarding Smith, who's not really a guy who's going to post up at this point in his career either. So I think having Smith helps. He's a little bit of a better passer, better defender, more aware than Terrence Jones. So I think it was the right move. And Jones is someone who might be able to have a little more success scoring-wise against some of the second units, but they also have been running out this unit with him at center, which didn't do too well in most of the games, except for Game 7. And I don't think that unit is going to have a prayer of stopping Golden State if they go to it, especially when Curry is on the floor.
Yeah, I think that one of the huge things in this series is going to be how the Rockets choose to handle the minutes when the Warriors, mostly their backups, are on the floor, because the Warriors, that lineup, if they play a lot with Livingston and Iguodala and those kind of guys together like they did in the regular season, those lineups have trouble scoring. They're pretty good defensively because they can switch and those guys are all about the same height and all that. And that unit is even more limited scoring-wise because Maurice Spates probably isn't going to play very much in the series. And David Lee is not Maurice Spates. And that's a sentence that's kind of amazing to say. But I think that how Houston and the Warriors counter each other in terms of rest, because we saw this again with the Clippers. You know, whenever the Clippers sat Chris Paul, the Rockets smoked them. And that wasn't so much that McHale was a genius at counter rotations. It's just because the Clippers' depth isn't that good. But how they choose to do that, because Kerr sometimes has this habit of playing his backups until they get in trouble. And that's exactly the type of thing that the Rockets could take advantage of.
I think some of the key stretches in this series will be the beginning of the second and beginning of the fourth quarters.
Yep.
That's usually when Harden will be out and Curry are out as well. And I think if they just have Dwight on the floor, that Houston is really going to struggle to score against what is, especially if the Warriors go with Azeli. Now, I expect them to they'll probably go with David Lee, I would imagine, at center, but he actually can hold up reasonably well when you have four guys around him: Barnes, Iguodala, Livingston, and then Thompson will usually come back in for the start of the second and the fourth quarters in the playoffs. I think that unit can really go on some runs through their defense, and that Houston is going to struggle to score quite a bit in those time periods.
Yeah, I agree, and that's that. Yeah, I mean, I would consider doing stuff, you know, like maneuvering the rest a little bit to maybe have Harden rest more, have his. But see, you wouldn't want his rest to parallel Klay Thompson because Klay's going to be on him. But also, I think Harden is the dominant figure, so you don't worry about who's defending him.
Yeah, so why don't we look at what the Golden State matchups are? They have their starting lineup. So how are you guarding then? I think they'll probably just guard straight up with Curry on Prigioni or Terry. Klay will be on Harden. He's done a very nice job on him. And then Barnes guarding Ariza, Green on Smith, and Bogut guarding Howard. And then I think, you know, they've got Andre Iguodala, who he probably won't get that much time on Harden. I think it'll be mostly Klay unless he gets in foul trouble, because Iguodala at this point in his career is more of a guy who's really good at helping and getting into the passing lanes and locking down one-on-one. We may see Sean Livingston get some time on Harden as well as another long-armed guy. So, I mean, they have many, many options to throw at him, unlike the Clippers, who basically had almost no good options to throw at James Harden.
Yeah, and you brought up a great point with Iguodala as a help defender, and I actually think we're going to see less of him on Harden than some people think, because his value isn't there. That's also why I think we'll see, some people have talked about Draymond Green on him. I think we won't see very much of that, because their value is in terms of mitigating the mistakes and everything of everybody else, and if they're occupied with somebody like James, that takes away what I would argue they do best. That doesn't mean that you take that completely off the table. I just think you minimize it. If Harrison can play even a small amount of minutes, like let's say 5 a game, guarding Harden without catastrophic consequences.
I don't like him.
Oh, I hate him. I hate it too. But if it's possible, that would be huge for the Warriors, because then that allows you to kind of balance things a little bit better. But I wouldn't expect that to happen very often. I actually am very intrigued by Livingston on Harden. I think that could work strangely well, though. I don't know. I feel like it could, but at the same time, I could if all of a sudden I heard that Harden was just blowing by him, that wouldn't surprise me either.
Well, yeah, I would be shocked if, unless there's severe foul trouble, if Barnes gets the assignment at all on Harden, just because Barnes is not, he's not necessarily the most intelligent defender at this point in his career, and I think Harden can take advantage of him to get to the foul line. I think what we're going to see a lot in this series is the Warriors switching everything 1 through 4. The Rockets don't really have a great post threat, and I think, you know, Klay Thompson, especially late clock, if they switch a 1-4 pick and roll, or I'm sorry, a 2-4 pick and roll with Harden and Smith, Thompson can hold up fine against Smith, especially because Howard will be right near the basket too, and Bogut can help off of him if needed. And then Draymond Green one-on-one against Harden, that might be something that Houston will want to go to early to see if they can get Green into foul trouble, which has been a big problem for him in these playoffs. But Green also is pretty good playing one-on-one defense, and as long as he can avoid fouling too much, we may see just a ton of late clock isolation step back J's by Harden, and that's not going to cut it ultimately for Houston to be able to score in the series.
Yeah, and something I should have brought up earlier when we were talking about fouls and the refs is that the other huge thing swing wise there is that all in the particularly in the Memphis series, Draymond and Bogut got called for more offensive fouls than they usually do. And that can also, not only can it affect them mentally, but that is the other way to get them in foul trouble. And so if refs are calling screens, if they're calling, you know, if they're calling charges a little bit more aggressively, that can also be a major factor, especially because, you know, the Rockets guys will kind of make some of those call, will make the refs try to make decisions in some of those situations.
Yeah, the Warriors also may be able to get some plays on cross matches in the series in transition like they did against Memphis, because Harden very likely will not be guarding Thompson. He'll probably be on Barnes, and then they'll have Ariza on Thompson, you would imagine. And so with that being the case, since Klay will be guarding Harden, Ariza will have to find Klay in transition, and the way the Warriors push the ball, that may lead to some open threes for Thompson.
Yeah, I definitely think so. So in terms of just the five who close the game for both these teams, are you expecting it to be the starting five?
I think so. For Houston, maybe it'd be Prigioni over Terry. But other than that, I mean, Ariza, Harden, Smith, and Howard seem like the best. You know, maybe they'll get Brewer out there as well. I don't know. I don't think they've gone to that no point guard lineup yet. So if they do, you know, it makes sense perhaps for some of the reasons you talked about, but we'll see whether they actually go to that or not. And then for the Warriors, I think depending on whether Barnes has it going or not, it's either him or Iguodala and the starters most likely for the Warriors, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that we're going to, you know, we're going to see that. And Harrison Barnes has played so well in these playoffs. It makes the Barnes-Iguodala decision that much harder.
Yeah, and I think against Memphis, it made more sense to have Barnes out there because he was going so well and they really needed his isolation offense in spots. But, you know, against Houston, it may be that Iguodala's ability to rotate and then recover back to shooters will be superior, but who knows? We'll just see how everyone is going. Yeah. I mean, I think the bigger, I don't think that Houston has a great chance of stopping the Warriors in this series, although they have been better defensively and were okay during the regular season. I think that they're a particularly bad matchup. And then on defense too, I think that, you know, a lot of what Harden does, I think the Warriors are really good at helping and then recovering out to the 3-point line. So I don't like this matchup for Houston. I do think that the season series has been overblown a little bit, but overall, my pick, and you can give yours in a second, my pick is 4-1 Warriors.
Do you know how frustrated I am that we keep on picking the same thing?
That's why I wanted to get my pick out first.
We aren't going to count. Well, actually, that's true. I was going to say, well, I made mine on radio today, but you made yours on the podcast yesterday. So, I mean, we're both there. But yeah, I think that the challenge for the Rockets is just that what they do well is not particularly effective against the Warriors, and what worked against the Clippers also will not be particularly effective because the Warriors are so much deeper, and they have. Like, what Curry's a great player, obviously. He just won the MVP, and Chris Paul is a great player, but they're excellent in different ways, and I think that it will be also, doesn't have a hamstring injury like Chris Paul does. I think that it's going to be a lot harder for Houston to contain Curry than it was Chris Paul.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So, why don't we move on now to the Hawks and Cavs. Let me be fair and let you make your pick before we even get into it, and I'll give mine.
Sure. Right now, I think we do have a disagreement here. I'm leaning Cavs in six.
Okay, yeah. I reluctantly am going Hawks 7, and my main rationale is that I just think that the Hawks offense is going to be a totally different animal for this Cleveland defense, which has not been particularly tested from a ball movement or shooting standpoint. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see what ends up being the most effective lineup for Cleveland. I think they're going to have to kind of muck things up a little bit more than you might have expected for a team that seemed like it was going to be really an offensive juggernaut. I think they're going to slow the pace down. They should be able to have more success with the LeBron and Kyrie ISO ball type of game than they did against Chicago. Jimmy Butler is just about the best guy in the league for guarding those type of LeBron ISOs with his strength and speed and intensity. So Damari Carroll is a good defender, but not quite a lockdown guy. And if the Hawks decide to spell him with someone like Bazemore, then that's going to be, LeBron is just too strong for him. So I think that they can really force double teams more easily. And also, probably the offensive rebounding for the Cavs is going to be enormous, especially when they have both of those bigs on the floor. So I think that there is a hope that Cleveland can kind of slow the game down, attack on the offensive glass, and kind of just bludgeon the Hawks to death over and over again. But on the other end, I'm not sure that they have the speed or the communication necessary to keep up with the Hawks' offense. I expect this to be a pretty efficient series offensively for the Hawks.
Yeah, I think this is a very different thing than what we talked about with Rockets-Warriors in that I can completely see how the Hawks can win the series. Like, you know, there is a clear path. You laid it out pretty well. The challenge for me is is twofold, and the main part of it is, to me, Damari Carroll has to have the series of his life. Because without Tabo Cephalosha, which is, it's crazy that it's kind of taken this long, but this is the series that I think they're going to miss him more than any other. Because they don't have a second guy to throw at LeBron. And so what that means is, when the Hawks are in different lineups like that, and also when the Cavs go real small at the four, or like, so let's say nominally LeBron plays power forward, but then they're playing with a guy like James Jones, so they'll put Damari Carroll on LeBron, is how do the Hawks answer that? Al Horford's a wonderful player. There's a lot that he can do, and part of what makes LeBron so special is that he is the best passer for his size of anybody in my lifetime, because I missed most of Magic. I mean, what he does is he can collapse the defense, but he's so good at finding the hole that you kind of don't want to collapse on him in that sense. And I feel like that's going to be a huge factor in the series. And the other one is, if Kyrie is close to 100%, if you're focusing on defending LeBron, then you're going to be having Jeff Teague on Kyrie, or maybe you use Bazemore, but they're gonna, and Schroeder a little bit, but it's hard for them to kind of contain both of those things at once.
Yeah, I could see foul trouble or just fatigue leading Coach Bud to have to spend less time with all five of his starters out there. And we've talked before about how when you have a team that doesn't have any stars, that you're more reliant on not having any weak links out there. And guys like Bazemore, Mike Muscala, they got some minutes out of, but if he's going up against Thompson or Mozgov, like, he's going to get thrown around like a rag doll. And so, I mean, I think that just some of the in-game vagaries here could lead to the Hawks not getting to play their best lineup a lot of the time, and that could be an issue as well. We haven't said it before, the Hawks are like one of the worst teams in the league protecting the defensive backboards, and Cleveland definitely bludgeoned the Bulls on that end, on the offensive glass. Both Thompson and Mozgov are excellent at that.
Yeah, that they have that going for them, and also just the challenge that you have of having two opponents who can beat you off the dribble and cause mismatches is something. The way I've thought about this series, it's actually kind of weird to reference a Nike commercial from like 5 years ago, but it was with Reggie Bush, that the concept of it was, my better is better than your better. And so the idea is basically that when I'm at my best, I'm going to beat you. And I think that that's broadly true for the Cavs, but the question is, will they be able to get there, especially without Kevin Love? And, you know, that's why this series is more fun and why it's more of a coin flip. And also, what will be a huge dynamic in this is, how do they want to handle playing LeBron with Shumpert? And where do you put Kyrie defensively in this series as well?
Yeah, and there's not going to be anywhere for him to hide like there was on Heinrich or even Dunleavy in the last series, because Korver, they'll run him off a ton of screens. Teague, they'll put him into a ton of pick and rolls. Carroll is probably too big. Maybe they'll try to hide him on Carroll, but that's, you know, that's sort of risking disaster from a physical standpoint there. I mean, you know, maybe they'll be able to get away with it. Who knows? But it's, although I don't know if I agree with you, I think actually that the Hawks' best is better than this weekend Cleveland team's best. I mean, I think that the Hawks, if you look at the heights that they reach with their offense in the regular season, Cleveland without Love isn't going to be able to quite get to that level. Even though they're both great offensive teams, I think that Atlanta, if they're really humming offensively, it can reach a height that I don't think this Cleveland offense without Love can quite get to. Maybe I'm wrong and I'm a little biased against their isolation heavy and throw it up and go get it on the offensive glass kind of strategy. But, I think actually that the Hawks do in their current incarnation have a higher offensive ceiling than Cleveland does. And they are a better defensive team throughout the course of the regular season.
Yeah. One thing that's interesting, we were talking about the idea of, you know, the Hawks balancing their starters and everything, is that I feel like Kyrie doesn't have a place to hide in the Hawks starting lineup, but I feel like whenever they're playing somebody other than those three, that's his place to hide. You know, Bazemore, Schroeder, whoever they're...
Schroeder, I think you can take advantage of him in pick and roll to some degree. But yeah, I mean, I think every moment Bazemore and Kyrie are on the floor together, he's going to be on Bazemore. I think you're right about that.
Yeah, and, but I think Schroeder comparatively is better. You know, like, I'd rather have Kyrie on Schroeder than on Carroll.
Yeah. No, that's probably right, yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, you have that. To me, the guy who's going to have to be huge for the Hawks is Horford, just because he's going to have to stem a lot of the bleeding. He's a great player. I thought him coming more into his own was what enabled the Hawks to, you know, close out the Wizards in the way that they did. But it's going to be tough because the Cavs have bodies. I mean, Mozgov, I think, has been a very underappreciated guy in this series, and he's not going to love floating out a little bit when Horford's humming from 15 feet. But he's a very good basketball player, and I don't know. I'm excited to see that because we haven't really had that Mozgov real test to me in this playoffs.
Yeah, that's going to be a fascinating dynamic, is whether Mozgov can stay on the floor or not. Are they going to pick and pop him to death with Horford? Mozgov has some strengths and he's played well, but he's also really, really slow.
Yep.
And him getting out on that Horford pick and pop, or even if Horford's hanging out in the corner where he can take some corner threes sometimes, that I think that'll be an issue. I think that it's going to be a struggle for Mozgov at times in the series. And then you're going to have to go with Thompson playing just massive minutes at center. And he's really improved defensively. I've been very impressed with him. He's excellent at switching out onto the perimeter. So that's when I think they might go to more of a switch heavy alignment. And you'll see then if I think that Cleveland can have some success stopping Atlanta if they've got LeBron at the four. I don't think Millsap can really do much against him if LeBron is locked in. And then Thompson at the five and then switching a lot of pick and roll action. The problem is how long can LeBron hold up playing the four legitimately when he's going to have to carry a huge offensive load? And same thing with Thompson. I mean, and then there's always the chance they get in foul trouble too. So they're going to need some minutes for Mozgov. We'll see how they do. We'll see if they start with that too big alignment or not. But I mean, I think that they are going to probably want to get Mozgov out there against someone like Antic as much as possible, but because he's someone who's not quite the threat. I would rather have Antic taking threes than Al Horford taking mid-rangers, because Antic just doesn't hit that well from three-point.
What you just got to was exactly what I was going to say, which is that I would rather, if I'm the Cavs, you just say, hey, Paro, you're open, just take it. You know, just have Mozgov do that, and then just have him ready there to get the rebound and be a help defender, because Paro Antic is a fun little player, but he's one of those guys, and there are a lot of them in the league, who it feels like he has more confidence in his shot than his shot warrants right now. Incidentally, Draymond Green was one of these guys before he started making them. But that's a challenge for the Hawks, because they pride themselves on ball movement, they pride themselves on getting the best shots, and you know, if he's getting a few of those looks, it might be hard for him to turn them down.
Yeah, Paro Antic, a fun little 6'11", 270-pound...
I mean little in terms of importance, not in terms of mass.
Well, all right, so anything else you want to say on this series before we move into some of the news of the day?
Let me think just a second. It'll be interesting. One of the things that you and I have talked a lot about in this playoffs is that these are two coaches that have gotten in their own way a fair amount. I mean, the Blatt did all the stuff that we talked about with pretending that Kyrie could defend Rose for the first 5 minutes of each game and then backing away from it. And Budenholzer has gotten away from what worked for the Hawks for stretches. And so I think in some ways it's going to be about who can straighten themselves out and kind of focus on what they do well first.
The coaching matchup will be really interesting. I think that Coach Bud in large part has gotten better as the playoffs have gone on. He's extended his starters more. He really, down the stretch in that Washington game, game six, he really went to them most of the fourth quarter. I mean, I think it's still a little disturbing how much he's willing to play Schroeder over Teague at times. And, I think his approach to foul trouble can be a little too aggressive, although at least he hasn't been quite as bad as he was in that net series. And then Blatt, I think, has done reasonably well at the matchups. He hasn't gone with the best matchups, but there's also maybe just an understanding that they need to preserve LeBron for a while, that having him matched up against Butler wasn't that good. I think LeBron will have, whether they're going to put him on Millsap and for how much, of the game, I think will be very interesting because he's their best option to defend Millsap, and they may struggle to get enough offense with both Thompson and Mozgov on the floor due to the lack of spacing. So how much Blatt is willing to go to LeBron on Millsap, how much LeBron is willing to do that, how much that affects his offense, those are going to be some real big questions that need to be answered in the series.
Yeah, and I think we'll see some of what, and it'll be a big test to see whether they can hold their ground, whether the guys like James Jones, whether they can defend the fours, because if they, I think it'll be a big problem, but Millsap's going to really need to press those advantages to scare the Cavs out of that kind of stuff.
Well, so why don't we move on now after the Clippers debacle? They've been in the news quite a bit today. You talked about what their situation is this offseason with DeAndre Jordan, a nice piece you wrote for Real GM today. You want to take us through that, and then we can discuss the implications?
Sure. So the challenge that the Clippers have is that DeAndre Jordan is an unrestricted free agent, which means that he can do whatever he wants. He can go. And so the Clippers can offer him more money, but that is a very different thing than it would be in other years because we don't know that he wants that five-year contract. He might be somebody who thinks that he could cash out in a shorter period of time because the cap's going to go up so much that the maximum salary. So even if he's not, let's say, a quote-unquote max guy in the new CBA, if he can jump up to $20 million from $15 million, that's pretty nice for him. So the challenge for the Clippers is that if he leaves, they're probably getting nothing. And with where they are, there are some teams where when you lose somebody for nothing, at least you have the cap space, you can get a replacement. With the money that they have committed to Redick and obviously Chris Paul, Blake Griffin, and some dead money that they have over, I think it's about $1.5 million in dead money to guys that they signed in the, or traded for and then cut for the most part in Farmar. And so what that means is that if he leaves, I think they're pretty much dead as a title contender for next year. They could obviously reboot in 2016 with more flexibility, but that's why he swings that. And the other challenge with that is it affects the way that they negotiate in free agency because we've seen in the past that teams, when a guy is an unrestricted free agent, they take this hard line, which is basically that they will not facilitate a move. It's what the Nuggets did with Andre Iguodala before they ended up doing it. I believe that Miami did a hard line like that with LeBron. And under the current CBA, the benefits aren't really there in terms of the player's salary. It's not like when LeBron left for Miami where they were able to pay him more money because he was signed and traded as opposed to signing him outright. So what that means is that it actually makes it a dangerous game if the Clippers want to say, hey, we're not going to help you go anywhere, because that increases the chances that if he wants to leave that he's going to go somewhere where they get absolutely zero and then can't replace him.
Yeah, and it only makes sense to do a sign and trade really if he's going to a team that's over the cap already.
Right.
And, you know, I'm not sure who that necessarily would be. I mean, it would probably have to be a team that could theoretically clear the space for him. But so we can talk also just about what the dynamic is now for DeAndre. Because he has finished now his seventh season, he was eligible for a contract that is about 30% of the salary cap this year. It's not quite 30%, but we call it the 30% max. It's a little bit less than that. But so rather than the 25% max, which you get if you have 0 to 6 years experience. So he can actually start at $19 million a year. And if he got a 5-year deal, that would be, I think, about $108 million. But so and we'll look at two scenarios here. One is he re-signs for that 5-year max. And if he does that, he's making $19 million in this first year. He gets 7.5% annual raises each year after that. If that's the case, then the Clippers have, if you consider them bringing back the non-guaranteed salaries of Crawford and Barnes, which they probably will, Crawford is $5.6 million and Barnes is $3.5 million. Those guys are decent value for what they are. Then you're already at about $85 million, maybe even more than that. If you're the Clippers, that number is relevant because you're over the projected luxury tax. The cap is $67.4 million projected. The tax is around $82 million projected. And with that being the case, now you can't sign anyone other than through the mini mid-level, which is about $3.4 million next year. And you're not going to get, and you can only do a 3-year contract there. So if you bring back DeAndre, there's not much else that you can do other than sign maybe one more guy you hope will be a rotation guy, although Doc's record in that regard isn't great. And then you're rolling pretty much with this group because they don't really have any assets. I mean, they have Redick, who maybe is on a value contract, but you need his shooting already. I mean, it's interesting because Doc was saying, oh, I looked at our contracts when we first got here, and, you know, they don't really have any bad contracts on this team. Maybe you could look at Hawes, but
that's their problem in some ways.
But they don't, it's not that they don't have any bad contracts, it's that they don't have any good contracts.
Well, it's kind of both, because something that the Cavs actually use relatively well, and they still have this with Brendan Haywood, is that sometimes you want to have a few higher ticket items because you can use them to balance in deals. And when you don't have that, when basically all of your guys that you're considering moving are on the lower end of your pay scale, it really hurts your flexibility because then you can't get into this untapped market of guys who are good but are more expensive than their team would want to pay for them. You know, like, for example, maybe like Rudy Gay on the Raptors. You know, like, the type of guy who there's no question that they're a good player, but maybe that team thinks they could do more with the space. It's the type of guy that Sacramento, that Utah, those teams should be going after all the time. And the Clippers are actually a great destination for a team like that because they have so much other money and they have an owner who's apparently willing to spend a ton of money. But
we'll see about that.
We'll see.
He's going to be into the tax.
Yeah.
Quite a bit here if they use that mini mid level, which they probably would. Sorry, I interrupted you.
Yeah, but so the challenge is that there just are a whole wealth of options that they have to basically take off the table because the only way they can get into those types of high-value contracts is by trading one of their big-ticket guys. And, you know, they could do that. I'm not going to say that they won't. But that's a very different conversation than if you have, let's say, like the Warriors, where you have David Lee making about $15 million. And sure, maybe a team doesn't love that, but maybe they'd rather have him expiring next year, and then you can take on somebody else's less palatable deal. The Clippers can't do that at all because you can't even combine guys like Jamal Crawford, Matt Barnes, and into even, you know, that kind of range. And why I brought up Haywood is that Haywood's contract, I'm going to write on this in the very near future, is one of the more interesting commodities because his contract is really high value, but it functionally is a zero contract in that way. So if they want to add an expensive piece that another team doesn't want, they can do that too. And that's the Cavs. They're the ones who have Haywood.
Yeah, well, so I think that another thing to consider, though, I'm not sure I agree with you there because I think that the problem is they don't have any assets to attach to those guys, and there aren't that many bad contracts around the league anymore of guys who can still play but are overpaid because contracts are so much shorter now and teams have been maneuvering for cap space. But that's an ancillary point. Let's say they do re-sign Jordan. Then in the what is supposed to be the bonanza year, a summer of 2016, cap goes up to a projected $89 million. They've got Chris Paul at $23 million and Griffin and Jordan both making $20 right there. So and then you have Redick and Hawes making a further $13 million combined. And so really, in a situation where you're going to have max contracts of, you know, $25 million for guys with the mid-level experience, $21 million for even guys from 0 to 6, they're not going to have that much flexibility even in 2016. So doubling down here with Jordan, that's going to be a cap bonanza, but the Clippers may not be able to take part in that really, you know, unless they're able to move Redick and Hawes. But because they are so limited in their picks, they gave up the first rounder this year for Doc Rivers. They gave up a 2017 first rounder to the Bucks to get off of Jared Dudley's contract. So that's the issue here with Jordan is you may be locking in with this core that you don't necessarily think is good enough with three guys making over $20 million, essentially. But what else can you do? I mean, the other option really is you don't re-sign Jordan. You try to just get someone with the regular mid-level of about $5.4 million because Jordan will be off the books, but you're still not going to be under the cap then. But they can at least use that. They won't be limited to the mini mid-level. Try to get by for a year and then make a huge splash in 2016-17. But the problem there is that, you know, Blake Griffin is in his prime. He's going to be 26. He'll be 27. He's a guy who's relying on athleticism a lot. Paul will be 31 next May. So it's really like this next year counts. Like, you can't just punt that year either. It's really a very difficult choice for them. Do you want to lock in with DeAndre, or do you want to just give up on a year and try to shoot for bigger fish, but worry then that Paul and Griffin won't be the same guys by then? And, so it's a very difficult choice.
And those guys will both have the option of being free agents the following year in 2017. So you have to play that. Do you want to commit to DeAndre Jordan and make them happy for these years, but then be paying him for 3 years after they have the right to leave? I mean, it's a really complicated situation for the Clippers.
Well, it's interesting you use the word make them happy, or the phrase make them happy, because there was an interesting report from Fox Sports, and the gentleman's name escapes me at the moment today, saying, talking to both some supposed friends of Chris Paul and sources close to DeAndre, saying that there's a real rift between those guys due to how demanding Paul is, et cetera, and that Jordan is also really focused on testing the market. He liked doing that back in the 2011 offseason. And so it's no guarantee that he comes back. And then there's also the issue that maybe he would want to re-sign for just one more year and then have a player option on the second year. That actually might be more of a boon for the Clippers in some ways, because then you have the best of both worlds. You can re-sign him for 1 year, and then you can still play in that 2016 free agent market if he decides to opt out then. But, you know, they still need him. He's the only guy on that team who can block a shot, and he's real good in the pick and roll. So whether you can find a better player than him for the money is also a question.
Yeah, the writer in question is Bill Reiter. That's who wrote the Fox Sports report. And I think that the 1+1, kind of what I've dubbed the LeBron special, is a really compelling option for both sides in this case, because that ensures that DeAndre kind of gets the power of choice in terms of when he wants to be a free agent. And for the Clippers, I think it really is the best case, because also that gives them the chance to really evaluate if they want to make a bigger decision. Because I think that at this point, I don't think they're ready to decide, you know, if you want to move on from Chris Paul or Blake Griffin, that might be a decision that they want to do at some point in the near future to get something for them while they're, you know, I would guess that Chris Paul would be more likely than Blake just because of where he is in his career. But I feel like if they have another year, then they can evaluate, they can really think, okay, can this team win a title? And then you make that decision. I mean, I think that if they keep him on a 1+1, then all of a sudden, if things are a little bit shakier at the 2016 trade deadline, then you start to maybe see some dominoes.
All right, well, gun to your head, DeAndre Jordan says, give me a 5-year max deal or I'm leaving. What do you do?
I give it to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Under the current structure, you give it to him. And because he's still young enough that he'll be of value, and even if you don't want him for that time, you'll be able to find a team that has cap space, that has trouble spending it. We're going to see that a lot. The estimates have it in 2017, that part of the reason the spike is so high is because they don't think teams are going to spend it in 16. I think that there'll be teams that have money to burn, and so if at that point you don't want him, somebody else will. So take him.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, you can always... I don't know about always, but I think you'll be, unless there's some sort of an injury situation, I think that's probably a contract that in the new reality starting in 2016, you would be able to move. I mean, I think that, you know, they bring the band back together. Paul has to start declining at some point. And although he was amazing in the playoffs, we did see some slippage from him this year. He was getting to the rim and his shots within the restricted area had declined quite a bit over the last couple of years. So, it's coming for him. I mean, he's done a great job getting better at shooting, which has been able to stave off the decline, and he got up to around 40% on threes this year. But, you know, he's going to be 31-year-old point guards who are, not that tall. It's it has to come at some point. I'm amazed at how well he's been able to maintain it so far, and he's a great player. He'll work as hard as he can. But, I mean, I think this is probably maybe the last chance with this group in some ways, and you might as well say, all right, maybe I, GM Doc Rivers, can do a little better job, learn some lessons from my screw-ups, get some guys who can provide a little bit more at the minimum or, you know, with that mini-mid level, and hope to come back and compete again next year.
And what Doc has to think about is a lesson from his old boss, Danny Ainge, that when a guy is towards the end of his usefulness, if you're not at the right stage in your development, that might be a time to do it. I mean, think about what the Celtics got for... I'm not comparing where they are right now in their careers, but you think about the kind of the masterstroke that the Celtics did with Garnett and Pierce to get them out and still get assets for them. I mean, there is something to be said for... As much as
I don't see Doc or Ballmer being anywhere near that forward thinking. I mean,
I don't either.
Ballmer paid $2 billion for this team because it has Chris Paul and Blake Griffin on it. I think that taking a step back is not something that they're going to be willing to consider, whether that's the right or the wrong decision. Yeah.
Unless they had intel that a heavy hitter was possible in 2016 or 2017.
Yeah. All right. One other little piece of news. Mark Stein reported that Alvin Gentry is going to interview at some point in New Orleans. That, I think, Alvin Gentry is one of the best candidates on the market, for sure. I think we both agree there. He's someone who can help their offense become a little more creative. I think he could come up with some great ideas to use Anthony Davis, although, you know, he's not renowned as a great defensive mind. I'm sure he could get a very quality assistant who could try to get the Pelicans better on that end. But, I mean, he's definitely one of the quality coaching candidates and, you know, I think would be a very good fit there. It's unclear when that interview is going to happen at last report from Mr. Stein, but, you know, that was one other thing that has to be noted. I mean, and it's well-deserved for him to get another shot as a head coach.
Absolutely, and I think that New Orleans would be wise to give him a very good shot at it because I think he's a great fit for what they have right now, and I think it'd be a good spot for him. I mean, Thibodeau makes some sense as well, but I'm supporting Gentry as the best fit for that job.
All right, well, I think that's plenty of talk for today. We'll be back tomorrow after Game 1. Of Warriors Rockets, not Clippers, Rockets. And we will talk to you next time. I'm Nate Duncan, NBA on Twitter. Danny is Danny LaRue on that same medium. And you can subscribe on the Real GM page or via iTunes. Always appreciate a nice rating on iTunes as well. And we'll talk to you next time. Thank you.